This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents Far North by Marcel Theroux. Read for you by Elena Schmulenson.
Part 1. Chapter 1. Every day I buckle on my guns and go out to patrol this dingy city. I've been doing it so long that I am shaped to it, like a hand that's been carrying buckets in the cold. The winters are the worst. Struggling up out of a haunted sleep, fumbling for my boots in the dark. Summer's better. The place feels almost drunk on the endless light, and time skids by for a week or two. We don't get much spring or fall to speak of. Up here, for 10 months a year, the weather has teeth in it. It's always quiet now. The city is emptier than heaven. But before this, there were times so bad I was almost thankful for a clean killing between consenting adults. Yes, somewhere along the ladder of years I lost the bright-eyed best of me. Way back, in the days of my youth, they were fat and happy times. The year ran like an orderly clock. We'd plant out from the hothouses as soon as the earth was soft enough to dig. By June, we'd be sitting on the stoop, potting broad beans until our shoulders ached. Then there were potatoes to dry, cabbages to bring in, meats to cure, mushrooms and berries to gather in the fall. And when the cold closed in on us, I'd go hunting and ice fishing with my pa. We cooked omul and moose meat over driftwood fires at the lake. We rode up the winter roads to buy fur clothes and caribou from the Tungus. We had a school. We had a library where Miss Grenadine stamped books and read to us in winter by the wood-burning stove. I can remember walking home after class across the frying pan in the last mild days before the freeze, and the lighted window sparkling like amber, and ransacking the trees for buttery horse chestnuts, and Carlo's laughter tinkling up through the fog as my broken branch went thwack, thwack, and the chestnuts pattered around us in the grass. The old meeting house where we worshipped still stands on the far side of the town. We used to sit there in silence, listening to the spit and crackle of the logs. The last time I went in there was 5 years ago. I hadn't been inside for years, and when I was a child I'd hated every stubborn minute I'd been made to sit there. It still smelled like it used to. Well-seasoned timber, whitewash, pine needles. But the settles had all been broken up to be burned, and the windows were smashed. And in the corner of the room, I felt something go squish under the toe of my boot. It turned out to be someone's fingers. There was no trace of the rest of him. I live in the house I grew up in, with a well in the courtyard, and my father's workshop much as it was in my childhood, still taking up the low building next to the side gate. In the best room of the house, which was kept special for Sundays and visitors and Christmas, stands my mother's pianola, and on it a metronome, and their wedding photograph, and a big gilded wooden M that my father made when I was born. As my parents' first child, I bore the brunt of their new religious enthusiasm, hence the name, Makepeace. Carlo was born 2 years later, and Anna the year after that. Makepeace. Can you imagine the teasing I put up with at school? And my parents' displeasure when I used my fists to defend myself? But that's how I learned to love fighting. I still run the pianola now and again. There's a box of rolls that still work, but the tuning's mostly gone. I haven't got a good enough ear to fix it, or a bad enough one not to care that I can't. It's almost worth more to me as firewood. Some winters I've looked at it longingly as I sat under a pile of blankets, teeth chattering in my head, snow piled up to the eaves, and thought to myself, "Damn it, take a hatchet to it, Makepeace, and be warm again." But it's a point of pride with me that I never have. Where will I get another pianola from? And just because I can't tune the thing and don't know anybody who can, that doesn't mean that person doesn't exist, or won't be born one day. Our generation's not big on reading or tuning pianolas. But our parents and their parents had plenty to be proud of. Just look at that thing if you don't believe me. The burl on the maple veneer, and the workmanship on her brass pedals. The man who made that cared about what he was doing. He made that pianola with love. It's not for me to burn it. The books all belonged to my folks. Carlo and my ma were the big readers, except for that bottom shelf. I brought those back here myself. Usually when I come across books, I take them to an old armory on Delancey. It's empty now, but there is so much steel in the outer door, you'd need a keg of gunpowder to get to them without the key. As I said, I don't read them myself, but it's important to put them aside for someone who will. Maybe it's written in one of them how to tune a pianola. I found them like this. I was going down Mercer Street one morning. It was deep winter. Snow everywhere, but no wind, and the breath from the mare's nostrils rising up like steam from a kettle. On a windless day, the snow damps the sound, and the silence everywhere is eerie. Just that crunch of hooves and those little sighs of breath from the animal. All of a sudden, there's a crash, and a big armful of books flops into the snow from what must have been the last unbroken window on the entire street until that moment. The horse reared up at the sound. When I had her calm again, I looked up at the window, and what do you know? There is a little figure hang-dropping into the books. He's bundled up in a bulky blue one-piece and fur hat. Now he's gathering up the books and fixing to leave. I shouted out to him, "Hey, what are you doing? Leave those books, damn it. Can't you find something goddamn else to burn?" Along with a few other choice expressions. Then, just as quick as he appeared, he flung down his armful of books and reached to draw a gun. Next thing, there's a pop, and the horse rears again, and the whole street is more silent than before. I dismounted, easy does it, with my gun drawn and smoking, and go over to the body. I'm still a little high from the draw, but already I'm getting that heavy-hearted feeling, and I know I won't sleep tonight if he dies. I feel ashamed. He's lying still, but breathing very shallow. His hat came off as he fell. It lies in the snow a few steps away from him, among the books. He's much smaller than he seemed a minute earlier. It turns out he's a little Chinese boy, and instead of a gun, he was reaching for a dull bowie knife on his hip that you'd struggle to cut cheese with. Well done, Makepeace. He comes to slightly, grunting with the pain, and tries to push me away from him. "Let me have a look at where you're hit. I can help you. I'm the constable here." But his clothes are too thick for me to examine him, and it's too dangerous to linger here, unarmed and dismounted, especially in daylight. It's not going to be comfortable, but the only thing for it is to move him. Better get the books as well, so the whole escapade hasn't been fruitless. I toss them into a burlap sack. The boy weighs nothing. It's heartbreaking. What is he, 14? I lift him onto the saddle and he rides in front of me, drifting in and out of consciousness until we get back. The good news is, he's still breathing. His arms reach feebly for my shoulders as I help him dismount. I know the pain is not so terrible for him yet. The body makes its own opium when it's been hit. But in the middle of that feeling, there is also a sensation of injustice, that you've broken something you don't know how to fix, and you won't be the same again. Once down, the boy refused to let me near him. As much as I tried to explain that I was sorry I'd hurt him and I wanted to help, he'd just slap my hand away. It was clear that we didn't have a common language. There are some tongues where you can get, say, one word in 5 or 10, and it's enough to make some sense of one another. We had nothing. I gave him a pitcher of hot water on a tray, and some long tweezers, and gauze, and carbolic soap, and left him to it. And I locked him in, just to be safe. The books from the burlap bag I put on the shelves in the living room. They were all odd sizes, so they didn't fit into neat rows like my parents' books. Some of them were picture books. I wondered if the boy was going to read them or burn them. I was pretty sure I knew the answer. A burned book always makes my heart sink a little. Every time I used a bullet, I made myself 5 more immediately. That had been my rule for a while. My bullets worked out pretty expensive, both in terms of time and the fuel it took to smelt them. It wasn't really economical to make them in such small quantities. But what I figured was this. You can always find more fuel if you run out. Chop out some hardwood and make charcoal. Even burn the pianola, God help me, if you have to. But you must never let things slide, get casual, and run low on shells. If you can find someone who'll trade with you, sure enough, a bullet has a market price. But say someone picks a fight with you, hunts you down with a posse of his friends. What price a bullet then? What price not to hear your gun go click on an empty chamber? Plus, I liked making them. I like what happens to the metal as it melts down. I like to crouch over the crucible, watching the flame through the smoke glass lenses that belonged to my father, watching the lead run like quicksilver. I liked the transformation and the cold, ugly slugs that I broke out of the sand and the molds in the morning. The trouble, of course, is that my shells were none too clean. If I ever get shot again, I hope it's with a nice, shiny bullet of surgical steel, not with one of my ugly things that looks like something someone dropped on a farrier's floor and carries God knows what dirt and germs in it. After I'd made my 5 bullets, I carried up some food and water and a light for the spirit lamp by the boy's bedside. He was plainly feverish. Eyes closed but flickering under the lids. Short, bristly black lashes. His blue-black hair on the pillow put me in mind of a crow's wing, muttering in that language of his. The pot was empty, but I took away the boy's stinking blue one-piece. He could have some of Carlo's old clothes, if he lived. At first light, I took him up some breakfast. There was nothing yellow about his skin. It was as white as bone. Faint black hair on his sideboards, but no beard or mustache to speak of. He'd eaten all the food I'd left him, but as I cast around for the chamber pot, he grew agitated. He was bashful. I knew then that I'd like him. I'd almost killed him, but he was shy for me to see his shit. How like a boy. I tried to make clear as best I could in gestures that he was to stay in bed and rest. He still looked none too good. But I'd only just mucked out the horses when he appeared in the courtyard, looking even younger and smaller in Carlo's plaid jacket and his slippers. He was unsteady on his pins, but he made his way over to the stall to watch me giving the mare her feed, and the sight of the horse seemed to please him. "Ma," he said, pointing at her. I started to explain how I never named the animals, just called them the mare, the roan, the gray. It doesn't seem right to give a name to something you're going to kill and eat one day. And it goes down easier as plain horseflesh than as a chunk of Adamski or Daisy May. But there was no way to make the boy understand, so from then on the mare became Ma. And then he pointed to himself, and the word he said sounded most of all like ping. That's right, ping. Like the bell on a shop counter. Like a button popping off your shirt, or a snapped banjo string. I wondered what kind of heathen name that was, or if there was a Saint Ping that no one had told me about. But Ping he was. A name's a name. And so I introduced myself to him. I pointed to myself and I said my name. Make peace. He looked all quizzical, squinted up his face as if he hadn't heard right and he wasn't sure if he dared say the word. So I said it again. Make peace. Now his face broke out in a broad grin.
Make a piss?
I looked at him careful, but he wasn't trying to poke fun at me. He just thought that was my name. And it seemed funny, since I had some laughs on account of his name, that he had made such a mess of mine. There wasn't any point in having Ping in my home and not trusting him. I'm ornery and solitary and suspicious, and that's how I've stayed alive so long. The last person other than me to sleep under that roof was Carlo, and that was more than 10 years earlier. But it seemed to me then, it still does now, that if you let someone in, you should let them all the way in. Whenever I rode out of the courtyard, I took the view that everyone I met was one way or another planning to kill or rob me. But I couldn't live like that in my own home. I decided to trust Ping, not because I had a gut instinct about him, I didn't know him from the Oriental Adam, but because that was the only way I could live. And yet, I was still a little surprised when I rode back in at lunchtime to find my locks intact, and the firewood still stacked neatly, and the chickens pecking, and the cabbage and apples in the root cellar undisturbed. There was no sign of Ping, though, and I confess that at that moment I felt sad at the thought that he might have left. I clattered up to the second story in my boots, hallooing on the stairs. No sign of him. I burst into Carlo's room and was taken aback by the scene I found. There was Ping, with a looking glass in front of him, and my ma's old embroidery case, and the spirit lamp burning away. And he was taking the old steel needles one by one, waving them in the flame, and sticking them into the flesh of his ears. He smiled to see me and laughed at my consternation. His whole ear bristled like porcupine quills. It must have pained him dreadfully, but he didn't seem put out by it. In fact, he just went right on sticking them into his ears. And when he'd done that, he put one or two in his nose, and one or two in his shoulder for good measure. I have a strong stomach. I have to. But the sight of that made me come over a bit queer. Ping gave me to understand that he wasn't crazy, that the needles were intended to do him some good for the wound in his shoulder. But what white or black magic that was, I'm afraid I can't tell you. Chapter 2. Ping had other strange habits. When the arm healed, he became an earlier riser than even me, and was up in the wintry darkness in the courtyard. It took me a while to catch him at it, but I finally stole down one morning and saw him out there, dancing. He moved awful slow and straight up, as if there was a jug balanced on his head. 10 or 15 minutes it went on, as he danced around the courtyard, waving his arms in the air, balancing on one leg at times, swooping down onto his haunches as well. He didn't seem put out that I'd seen him when he'd finished. "What the hell was that?" I asked him.
"Gong Fu. Gong Fu," he said.
And that was it. He tried to show me a few steps of his gong fu, but I didn't really take to it. It went so slowly, I'd start thinking about what a fool I looked, and then pretty soon I start thinking about other things, my mind wandering all over the place, thinking about Carlo and Anna and my ma and pa, and by then I'd have my feet all in a tangle, and Ping would be laughing at me. But it didn't do me any harm. And to tell the truth, I had some good ideas while I was doing it. Having Ping there had given me a notion to go traveling. There were caribou herders in the northern mountains who were happy to trade meat for whiskey. The trouble was their pastures were way up high and far off, across miles of boggy ground. To get there in summer took a month, and even if I made it, the meat would spoil before I'd had a chance to bring any of it home. And in winter, I never liked to leave the house empty for too long. It was traveling weather, and there were desperate, hungry people on the move. But with Ping in the house, it would be a different matter. I could take a sled along the winter roads and bring back all the meat I could carry. It would stay deep frozen, and Ping and I could eat it until the thaw. My mouth watered at the thought of all that fresh meat, and Ping looked like he could use the iron. His face was all pale and washed out. Once a week, after Ping finished his dancing, he'd take my straight razor and shave his head. He had a cute touch with it, because I never once saw him cut himself. A few days after the idea came to me, I went to him while he was shaving and used a piece of charcoal on the whitewashed wall of the pantry to show him what I was planning. I hitched Ma to the old sled and loaded it with bottles of whiskey. How I came by those is another story. I took a tent and bedroll. I ate so much the night before I set off that I began to sweat and had a stomachache. And in the morning, I left at the first light along the frozen river that led out of town. Naturally, I packed my guns and ammo and few other bits and pieces, and before I went, I showed Ping how to use the rifle. There was a bunch of dirty tents along the riverbank and the stink of smoldering rubbish. I passed a skinny woman gathering frozen berries on the edge of town. She was the first I'd seen in a while. She smiled at me and pulled open her coat to show me her lank titties, but I gee-upped the mare and kept moving. Human beings are rat cunning and will happily kill you twice over for a hot meal. That's what long observation has taught me. On the other hand, with a full belly and a good harvest in the barn and a fire in the hearth, there is nothing so charming, so generous, no one more decent than a well-fed man. But take away his food, make his future uncertain, let him know that no one's watching him, and he won't just kill you. He'll come up with 101 reasons why you deserve it. You slighted him, you looked at his woman wrong, you wouldn't lend him a hatchet, you got more land than him. Your beans have took and his didn't. And you know what else? You just never wrote to thank him when he gave you that hot meal that time. I heard that in the days when there were proper lawmen and judges and trials, and you could enter a plea when you were charged, people were fond of saying, "Your Honor, I acted in self-defense." But everyone acts in self-defense. That's the one certain thing. The man scalping you, the rowdies firing your corn, the gunmen separating you from your cheap turnip watch. There was a bed of fresh snow on top of the ice, which gave the mare's hooves something to bite into. I'd dismount and walk beside her for spells. There were a few last signs of human settlement along the riverside. A burned-out cabin, a wooden cross on a grave, some tumble-down walls. But then, we were in the high country, nothing but trees as far as the eye could see, and the mountains behind. Isn't it strange that after so many years we never made a bigger dent on the land? My heart lifted to have left the last of so-called civilization behind me, and just before sunset I bagged a pair of snowy white partridges for my supper. The first was a clean shot. The second fell, still fluttering, off his perch, and I gave him his quietus with my boot. In the morning I broke down the tent and we were off moving again before first light. My mind started to wander in the half-dark. I wondered what Ping was doing. and I thought of my life in that godforsaken place, doing a job that I hadn't been paid to do for years, for a citizenry that was determined to take each other to hell as soon as possible, and I wondered why I still bothered with it. I was enough of a frontiersman to live well outside the town. I didn't need to plunder or steal food or kidnap to stay alive. I went through it a few times in my head, and it seemed to me that the only thing keeping me there was that house, that I was still keeping a part of the old life alive, in the hope that one day Ma and Pa and Carlo and Anna would come back to it. How lucky we are when we don't know we're lucky. Not to live among desperate people, getting paid, worrying about roof slates and why the bread won't rise. I thought about the woman in the woods, with her titties and her broken teeth. What might she have been if things had turned out different? When she was a babe in arms, her father never thought she'll end up picking frozen berries and pleasuring strangers for food. That's why I say we live in a broken age. It was 5 days traveling before I reached the mountains. The caribou herders have been in those mountains for thousands of years, way before any of the white men got here. They always lived a simple life, following their herds up to the summer pastures and back down in winter, and it stood them in good stead. My father always preferred to do his work by hand, even when there were plenty of machines to make the work easier. We were always pushing him to get newer things, because like all children, we were in love with what's new, but he wouldn't be told. More things to go wrong. Just another thing to break. The more complicated a thing is, the more badly it breaks down. He was certainly right about that. The caribou people, on the other hand, they kept things simple. Followed the seasons, never used anything they couldn't fix themselves, no engines to break down, eat, ride, and wear the same animal. I couldn't live like them for any length of time. I like to sleep on a sprung mattress between sheets in a nightshirt. I like milled flour when I can get it, fresh vegetables. But more and more I had begun to think I was the last of my kind, and my children, if I ever had any, would have to be more like the caribou people if they were to raise any children of their own. In the old days, the caribou herders were trappers, too, back when there was a call for fur and it fetched high prices out west. The winter roads were busy in those days, and traders were up and down them as soon as they'd frozen in November and kept on traveling until the thaw. It was ghostly deserted now, but right where the river described a sharp bend back on itself, on the fringe of caribou country, just on that knuckle of land overlooking the frozen river, stood a hut, and judging by the plume of smoke coming out of the tin pipe in its roof, an occupied one. There were half-built sleds worked out of larch all around the yard. A big caribou carcass, skinned and frozen, dangled off the stoop, and a half-dozen skins were tanning on a frame behind the hut. A dog came out of a little lean-to, pulling itself tight on its chain, and barked itself silly as soon as it heard our runners scraping along the ice. The hut door banged open, and a tall Tungoose fellow hailed me from his porch with a raised hand. I could see the hut was emptyish, because there was only one coat on the stoop. It was always my plan to get the trading over with as soon as I could, without going any deeper into the mountain country that I needed to, so this suited me just fine. In I went to the hut, which was dirty but warm, and by the looks of things home to 4 or 5 herders, all, save my host, out at that moment with a herd. He boiled up some tea and fried some caribou meat for me, which tasted fine after that long journey, and I told him my business. His name was Solomon, and he was the camp cook, he said. He told me to bide my time with him, and the other fellows would be home presently. He was sure they'd be keen to trade. Up on the shelf in the hut was a dead 3-legged wolf, wrapped up in string and parcel paper. Solomon said it had been preying on the herd for months and had been a son of a bitch to catch. In the end, They had put down poison to get him, which they weren't proud of, being hunting people. They were intending on carrying it back to the village with them, because their headman paid a bounty for wolves. One by one, the herders trailed in as sun set, banging through the hut door and sitting down at the filthy table without a word for some food. Solomon served him hunks of caribou, which they cut into thin shreds with their own knives and dipped in salt before they ate it. Then he gave them a soup of caribou tripe, which smelled vile to me, but I guess it's the closest they had to greens in the winter months. As soon as one had finished eating, he would wipe the crumbs off the oilcloth with his hands and onto the floor and get up to make way for the next one in. One stretched out on his ragged bed with a battered old guitar and sang a song to himself. I had eaten a heap, traveled a long way, and the stove was pumping out heat, so I soon found myself drifting off to sleep on the cot they'd let me have. But I woke up in the middle of the night with a guitar player standing over me, asking me if I wanted to make him a trade for one or both of my guns. I let him know plainly that the only way he'd be getting one of my bullets was in his head, and very shortly if he didn't back off. He shrank back, complaining that I was being unfair. I said he should know better than to trouble someone when they're sleeping, and that we would talk about trade in the morning. First thing after breakfast, I showed them a bottle of my whiskey. They were keen for it, I could see immediately, but they tried to play it off in their simple way, as though they weren't too impressed with it. I knew otherwise, but I indulged them so they wouldn't lose face. We haggled for a while over the price of the meat. I had been thinking that the smart thing for me would be to take the caribou live. I could hitch them to the cart, they'd travel under their own steam, eating lichen from under the snow, and I could butcher them whenever I wanted. But the herders were adamant that in that case I'd have to pay for the skins as well. So we fixed on a price, spat and shook hands on it, and drank a tot of whiskey together. Then they brought four caribou out of the herd and butchered them. They killed them one by one out behind the hut, gentling them until the last minute, so the fear wouldn't taint the meat and make it stiff. The animals' eyes rolled as their throats were cut, and blood sprayed onto the snow. Then they dragged the carcasses away to flay the skins off and gut them, steam rising up from their innards as their eyes glazed. I let the herders keep the tripe, since they were so keen on it. The butchering was done, the sled was loaded up, and I was ready to leave by mid-morning. I had no desire to stick around there while those fellows binged on the whiskey. If they had sense, they would trade it on, but I wasn't sure they did. And the guitar-playing fellow, whose name was Gustav, looked like he was fixing to go on a holy bender. It turned out he was much smarter than that, and I must have let my guard down, thinking that there was no one within 50 miles but a dead wolf and a half-dozen drunk caribou herders. Because after leaving the hut and traveling all day, I broke my journey to make camp, and when I woke up in the morning, I found that someone had lifted my guns as I slept. My rifle, both my sidearms, and a great box of shells that had taken a great slice of my life to cast, all gone. I cursed heaven for my being idiot simple, and my mother for raising a fool, and the reindeer herders for their criminal cunning, and a good many other curses, none of which in the least succeeded in bringing my guns back to me. I had one old shotgun back at home, and the rifle which I'd left for Ping to use, but nothing else. There was no doubt that without my weapons I was dead, so I was left with a simple choice. I saddled the mare and followed the tracks. Gustav had made no effort to hide them, figuring that I would hesitate before I went in pursuit of an armed man. I knew I had a faster mount since he was riding a caribou, but he had God knows how many hours' head start over me. I was careful not to catch him too quick. I knew my best chance was to creep up on him at nighttime, as he had me, and when I sensed I was getting close, I dismounted and went on foot. His cooking fire was what I spied first, and his tent beside it. There was no point approaching him until dark, so I bided my time. Now, I had been running a few plans in my head, but as soon as I saw how he had left his camp, I knew what it was to be. I crept up in the darkness and set his tent alight with embers of his cooking. The floor of his tent was reindeer skin, but under that he had packed dry branches so as to sleep more soft. It caught quick, and the smoke and heat must have made him more dozy for a while, or perhaps he had been drinking, because it was a while before he appeared, like a drowsy bee staggering away from a smoked-out hive, happy to have saved his skin, then less happy when he realized the fix he was in. Traveling in the far north in winter, it's always best to hang your coat outside your tent. The Tungus are pretty strict about it. Mainly it's for the sake of the fur. It molts less and stays in better shape. But there's another reason also. It's 100-to-1 chance, but it's worth considering that if you're caught short in the night, or you have to go outside for something, and by sheer bad luck or otherwise you kick your stove over, your tent will go up, and so will everything in it. And just after you finish congratulating yourself for not burning to death, you'll look up at the star-filled sky and you'll hear the ice crystals in your breath tinkling together, making the sound they call the whisper of angels, and you'll rub your shirt-sleeved arms and a bad feeling will come over you. If I'd been that herder, I would have put one of the bullets from the stolen guns through my own head before I froze to death, because freezing to death is a terrible way to go. There were 40 degrees of frost that night, and it took him almost 2 hours to die. The last thing that happens to you when you freeze is your body feels like it's burning up. Your heart pumps the last of your hot blood to your skin as your organs shut down. That's why you'll tear off your clothes even as your liver is turning to ice. I found him in the morning, followed the trails of his clothes deeper into the woods, and came upon him, naked, bluish, with rime on his hair and his Johnson frozen. Luckily, he still had on my guns. Chapter 3. Killing always sits heavy with me. Whether that's because of my being a woman, or because my disposition is naturally soft-hearted for another reason, I don't know. I've had to fight the womanish things in my nature for almost as long as I can remember. These are not soft-hearted womanish times. Being tall and broad in the shoulders and deep-voiced, it's been easy enough to pass for a man, but I still shed some tears over that lousy herder, though I railed against myself for the weeping, because I knew he would have shed none for me. Softness and conscience and good faith is like the pianola or the books in the old gun store in Mercer Street. They have no place in these times. Yet, just because I don't eat dainty and I don't scruple to kill and I can't dance or read music, that doesn't mean I don't hanker after doing so. Wild dogs had took some of the meat from the sled, but there was still a good quantity of it left, so I guess you could call the journey a success. I had fresh food, and I still had my guns, and when I called to the mare, she came out from the stand of larches where I'd left her hobbled. We were slower on the journey back on account of the extra weight. It was a week's traveling instead of 5 days, and I pulled into town beat and smelling pretty ripe. When I knocked on the gate, Ping peeked out of an upper window with a rifle, and his face lit up to see me. We hung the meat out back out of the sunlight, and then I got to thinking I would like to clean myself up properly. It had got colder since I'd been away, and the water in the well had frozen. Ping had been making do somehow, not knowing any better, but I hated to go short of water. There was still some light left in the day, so I took Ping out to the lake on the cart with the ice saw, and we cut blocks for a couple of hours until we had a load. The blocks sparkled in the lengthening yellow light, like outsized sugar candy or pale blue Turkish delight dusted with powdered sugar. We took them home with us and stacked them in the courtyard. I lit a fire in the stove in the bathhouse. My pa had built it of cedar wood, and the air inside smelled sweet even when it was cold, but when it got hot, the perfume seemed to seep out of the wood and crackle in your nostrils. I heated a little water in a copper kettle on the stove, and when it was near to boiling, I heaved in one of the ice blocks. It hissed and cracked on the heat. It took a good hour for the bathhouse to get hot enough for steam, and by then the sun had set, and the stars pricked the navy blue of night like needlepoints. I bundled myself up in a thick robe with towels and slippers as I crossed the yard. The smoke rose lazily on the freezing air, dropping as it cooled, until it spread sideways across the sky like a clothesline. I hung my things up on the hooks outside the hot room, and went through that creaky door to face the wall of dry heat. The dirt seemed to leach out of me, making grubby pools in the folds of skin on my belly. Ping was clattering outside in the yard, maybe hesitant about coming in, so I called his name. There was the squeak of tight wood, and his face appeared in the crack of the door. I didn't want to lose any heat, and the blood beating in my ears had made me fierce, so I yelled at him to get inside or shut the door. And the next thing is, he's standing inside, done up tight to his neck in Carlo's old dressing gown and a few rolled towels, not an inch of skin showing. He was looking at me wide-eyed. And I realized, of course, that he was staring at my tits, which had dropped out of the towel, and below that my bush. It must have been a shock, since he was expecting to see a fellow, to see a raw-boned girl in the buff, but it wasn't going to make any difference to me. I knew what I was, and I didn't know how I was going to break it to him otherwise. But he stared for a long time, and then his mouth opened as though he was about to say something, and then his hands trembled on the knot of the dressing gown as he tugged at it, as though he was in a hurry to get it off. And it passed through my mind that he'd seen something he liked and wanted a piece of, which was not my intention at all. So I'd bunched my fists to give him the lights out if he took one step closer. But the next thing is, he's dropped that old gown and half-doubled up with sobs. And strangest of all, it seems that Ping is a woman. There is no mistaking it. The pinch at the top of the hips, and the small oriental bosoms and coal-black thatch of her bush. And that's not the end of it. By the swell of her belly, it appears to me that she's not 3 or 4 months with child. I let my hands drop, and I felt Ping's arms round me, and the rasp of her bald head on my cheek, and she howls into my ear like a soul that has lost its body. Being a woman in these times, I know some of what she's crying for. The world fighting itself like cats in a bag, the ordinary cruelty, the piles of unburied bones bleaching at the western edge of the town. And then, there's her relief. She must have been worrying days how to tell me. With a shudder, I recalled that shot in her shoulder, and thanked God I never slung her belly down over the saddle. She let me touch her stomach. There was a line down the middle of it, like the seam on a broad bean, only dark, and her nipples were chocolate brown and wide. I began to wonder how I ever could have thought she was a man. The truth is, save me, I never encountered a woman in the last 10 years who wasn't more or less some man's wife or property. I wondered how she was living, where she came from, who the father is, but there are no words that would make her understand my questions. Right then, she felt so small in my arms that it seemed like I was the mother and she my child. I held her and caressed her baby bald head until her sobs were just sniffles, and I couldn't tell if she was sleeping or waking. There was a stillness in the house the next day. Ping came down the stairs sleepily much later than usual and looked at me almost shyly after the surprises of the night before. And the world felt a little different that morning with the idea of new life in it. Chapter 4. It was late January when I came back from my visit to the caribou herders and learned Ping was with child. With the help of a calendar and some drawings of the moon, I got her to show me the likeliest time of conception, and we calculated that the baby was due to arrive around midsummer. As spring got closer, I started thinking about cultivating some more land, since there was going to be more of us. The one thing I had in abundance was packet seeds. Almost everything useful had been plundered from the stores downtown over the years, but a few oddments of things had got left behind, and in the farm supply on Willow Street there were boxes and boxes of packet seeds that no one had thought to touch. It stands to reason that if you're chiefly concerned just to live until tomorrow, you must think how to fill your belly today and find a way to defend yourself. Those two are tasks enough, believe me, so no one paid too much mind to planting a crop. Those packets were stamped with dates in the past when they were supposed to go bad, but I knew that was just nonsense. A seed keeps its power. There are plants in the desert south where the seed just bides its time for 100 or so years in the sand, waiting for the rain. Just waiting for a moment to bloom again. I've never seen it, but I've heard that every century or so the rain comes, and that whole bare stretch of rock and sand is a mess of flowers and plants. On top of the firehouse is a lookout tower they used to use for spotting blazes in the forest. One day, after I'd been collecting seeds from the store, I clattered up the rungs and peered along the highway, east and west, watching it fold through the trees in the distance like a ribbon of white silk. The city looked emptier than I had ever known. I tried to be thankful for it. I missed what it used to be, but between me and then stood an impassable gulf, a river of blood and fire. It's habits that keep you straight when everything else around you is falling apart. Calling myself constable, keeping the tack clean and the horses in shape for the morning ride was all that stood between me and hopelessness, at least until Ping came. I knew I hadn't been constable in anything more than name since Carlo died. It occurred to me for the first time that maybe I was the last. Maybe me and Ping were all that was left. Up to a month or two before, I knew of at least three families scraping by in different sections of the city. But at that moment, looking down from the old tower, I couldn't see a sign of any of them. The mist had lifted from that morning, and it was a gray, frosty day of about 20 below, but there wasn't so much as a curl of smoke from a household fire. This place had been my life for as long as I could remember. I thought of the time before I was born when my parents had come to that city, along with all the other pioneer families. And in a half a lifetime or so, it had emptied out again. From where I was standing, I could see trees growing out of the bleachers round the softball field, which itself was a maze of scrubby bushes. The billboards along Main Street had shriveled in the weather. The drugstore where I used to drink malted milk was a hive of blackened glass and wood. The train station that the line had never reached remained half-built and now would never be finished. All those hours and days of human struggle, thousands, millions of them spent building up this place, only to have it kicked down like an anthill by a spoiled child. This place had promised the first settlers everything. Now what was it? A ghost town, decaying back into wilderness. There wasn't a soul left in the whole place save us. I grew surer of it by the day. Imagine, a city of 30,000 souls reduced to 2 women in a bump. And yet the odd thing was, I liked it a whole lot better. I started going round it by foot, something I hadn't done for years. It made me feel closer to the place somehow, crunching the broken glass and paper underfoot, spying the discarded things. A filthy doll. Some spectacles. Broken shoes. That told the story of my city. The houses where the Challoners and the Velasquezes had been living were abandoned. I put the ladder up to their outside walls and had a look in. There was a pitiful, scrawny tabby in the Challoners' yard, but no sign of a person. At the Velasquez house, I could see the place had been left orderly, with its furniture intact, and some sign that the garden had been dug, but there was no doubt they were elsewhere, too. That killer Rudy and his brute of a son, Emil. With the last humans gone, it seemed like nature decided to reclaim everything. On Considine Avenue, I came upon a herd of wild pigs, at least 12 of them, rooting around the old garbage heaps. The adults were black and square like steamer trunks. I emptied both pistols from horseback and managed to hit 2 of them, while the rest ran off squealing. I butchered them then and there on the street and dragged them home, chucking the lights and offal into the Challoner's yard for the tabby. Once I reached home and glanced back at the long smears of blood on the ice in the roadway, a strange feeling came over me. I unbuckled my empty guns and laid them on the kitchen table. It occurred to me that that was the first time in 15 years I'd been anywhere in the city without a loaded weapon. We ate to bursting for days, smoked a flitch for the summer, and tried not to think too hard about what they might have fattened on. I later regretted my generosity to the cat, because Ping knew a way to make dried sausage with intestines. The other thing I noticed was the birds. By April, the birdsong was so raucous in the mornings that it was waking me up in the dark. And the types of them had got so various. I know my eating birds, but the smaller ones? I can name a sparrow and a robin, and that's it. But I could see we had a whole new menagerie. The circumstances had changed so much. They had all the windfall and the berries to themselves, so many new places to roost. Ping and I were beginning to find ways to talk to each other. I never had much of an ear for her language, but we had chai for tea and dinner for pretty much every mealtime, and a bunch of other words that helped simplify our lives together, though we were way off discussing politics or sharing our life stories, which suited me, in fact. The first time she felt the baby move, a look of astonishment came across her face, and she gabbled in her tongue and put my hand on her stomach. But I couldn't feel a darn thing, even though she was tapping my arm with her finger, trying to let me know what I was supposed to be feeling for. 6 or 8 weeks later, I was able to feel something stirring in that little melon belly of hers, and by April, I could make out distinct shapes, but I was never too sure if it was a foot or a buttock or a tiny head that I was feeling. Ping was sure it was a girl. I don't know how. She spent evenings cutting patterns for her tiny dresses. That little thing seemed to like the pianola. She got very lively after I had played one of my roles. I hoped she'd be musical and maybe figure out how to tune it, because the songs didn't sound much like they'd used to sound. That whole spring was one of the great times in my life. Ping bloomed, and she let her hair grow, and her belly swelled and swelled. I spent some happy hours in the farmer's supply choosing seeds for the garden. They gave me a great feeling of hope for the future, those little brown packets. Beans and corn, spinach, squash, and rutabaga, radish, melons, peas, tomatoes, zucchini, cabbage, and chard. I started turning the soil with ash and horse shit as soon as the thaw began, and I thought, hell, let's plant some flowers as well. So I got a whole bunch of them. Cotton easters, candy tuft, marigolds, pansies. Waking early every day to that chorus of birdsong and planning my garden, it really felt to me that some sanity and color and orderliness had come back into my world. Late in April, I was up in the lookout again with a spyglass, and I caught something moving out on the roadway far to the east. First dust, then a column of people moving out of the horizon and toward us. It's eerie, the silence, when you look at a thing like that from far off through the glass. You know there are sounds. Horses laboring under a heavy load, whips and sticks, chains clanking, men cussing out the stragglers, but you can't hear them. And the spyglass flattens it all out like a tableau in a picture book. The thing it called to mind as it came into view was the big color picture of Moses parting the Red Sea in my children's Bible. It showed how the walls of water on either side were smooth like glass, and between them, on the dry seabed, fish lay flapping and dying under the feet of the fleeing Israelites. Way in back, Pharaoh's army was just about preparing to go between those high blue walls. Pharaoh's chariot was pulled by a pair of big, snorting black horses, and I had nightmares where I could hear their hooves as they gained on me, and I'd fall on my knees among the gasping fish, thinking, "Let it be quick, let it be quick!" Before I woke up to the sound of Carlo's open-mouthed breathing, and the room still filled with that watery early morning light. I wouldn't normally have put myself in the way of trouble, but since Ping came with her baby, I felt less careful about my own life. I was, after all, the sole representative of the law in the municipality, and it didn't feel right for me to be skulking round like a thief at a wedding while this huge caravan of people moved past right outside my city. The highway skirted the north side of the town. A metalled road ran up to it, but 10 years of freezing and thawing had broken it into rubble. I didn't like to risk the mare's legs on it, so I galloped across the open ground instead. The whole column must have had close to 200 souls in it, and the whole thing slowed to a halt as they saw me coming. I wasn't minded to get too close, so I stopped short about 50 yards away from them and waited to see if anybody would come. My horse pawed at the dirt while I waited. I could feel hot eyes on me. There were 5 or 6 men on horseback bossing the prisoners. I counted at least 3 rifles, and I was beginning to regret my boldness. Then a tall, lean fellow rode out of the line, coming in close beside me, and tipped his hat. He had a sharp, leathery face, blue eyes, and the fingers that held his bunched reins were long and thin. He licked his cracked, narrow lips and spat into the dirt.
"Looks like the rain is going to hold off."
"Depends how long you're on the road," I said.
"About 4 more weeks."
The gun he was wearing on his hip had a long silver barrel, as thin and dainty as one of his fingers. I sensed he was afraid there was more of me, dug in somewhere around. He seemed cool and relaxed, of course, as a pharaoh should be, but what gave him away was the eyes of his men, fidgety, flicking around to see who was lying in wait.
"What are you trading?" I asked him.
Those blue eyes of his narrowed into steel splinters. He said nothing. I looked at the sullen faces in the line, all those filthy clothes, taking the chance of a stop to rest on their haunches. Peasant girls, some Chinese, some with chapped red cheeks, some darker, Asiatic-looking natives.
"First time I've seen you come by here," I said.
I knew if he was silent again, it spelled trouble. He gazed down at his hands, which were folded on the saddle pommel, and looked up slowly, as though to let me know he was in no hurry to answer my question.
"We came through here in January."
"How about that?" I said to fill his pause. I was calculating how quick I could draw on him and then spur on the mare to get away from there. My heart was hammering, time seemed to be slowing down, and my eyes had that keenness that comes as your body dumps those fight chemicals into your blood. I could pick out individual grinning faces on horseback behind him.
"As a matter of fact," he went on, "I lost a girl somewhere around here. You didn't happen to come across a stray, did you?"
I shook my head.
"Too bad. I'd taken a shine to her."
Leather creaked as he shifted in his saddle.
"Nice visiting with you."
He tipped his hat and spurred his horse back the way he'd come, and his men roused the sitting prisoners into moving again. I stayed for a long time without turning my back on them, partly out of curiosity, wondering about all those people, masters and slaves, and where they'd come from, and what lives they'd been leading, but also in case any of them were minded to take a potshot when my eye was off them. There were times when I wondered if I had done the right thing staying behind when everyone else had left or died. That day, watching the column of people vanish into the dust raised by their own feet,